Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Brendan Ballou, a federal prosecutor who served as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's antitrust division. We're going to talk about his first book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. And you can learn more at plunderthebook.com. On Free Forum, we'll explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I usually account for the failure of the United States to do what's needed to confront the crises we face. Crises that I believe have either grown out of the distortion of our economy and our politics or are unsolvable because of them. And the list I usually choose is inequality, climate change, an unhealthy relationship with the rest of nature, pandemics and public health, social and racial division and tribalism, crippled government, and endangered democracy. Those are huge crises that we are not dealing with adequately, and may not even with our current system of politics and economics be equipped to do so. And I usually point towards a combination of greed and minority rule. Now, I looked into private equity, eager to learn whether it actually even relies on minority rule, or whether in this case, since both parties seem to enable it equally, for the most part, greed alone is sufficient. As I launch into this conversation, I can't help feeling reminded of 2006 when I did my first show on the subprime crisis and its dangerous financial tools, credit default swap, securitization, etc. I'm likewise reminded of a remark attributed to former Fed Chair Paul Volcker that the last useful or beneficial financial innovation was the ATM. I've been vaguely aware of private equity for years, certainly of the leading companies, Blackstone, Carlyle, KKR, etc. I knew it had something to do with Sam Zell's purchase and destruction of the Tribune Company in the LA Times, and of the slow rot of nursing homes, which became deadly during the pandemic. But I guess I assume this was just the latest vehicle for community and company and society destroying greed, and I hadn't been curious to look under the hood. Today's guest confesses that he also didn't understand private equity until he started the research that led to this book, Plunder. What is private equity? Well, here's a spoiler alert. I'm going to tell you a few of the main points Brendan Ballou makes in defining private equity by its method of purchasing companies and then three characteristics or flaws of how it operates in the larger system. Private equity investors take a little of their own money, some investor money, and a whole lot of borrowed money, and they buy up companies. Then they try to make changes and sell them at a profit in a short time, a few years. Private equity wants to sell quickly, so the need to make money quickly drives decision-making. Private equity loads the companies they purchase with debt and extract a lot of fees. And private equity are legally shielded from liability for the consequences of their actions. Think about that last one. The way I saw it is corporations shield individuals. Well, private equity shields corporations. We've had short-term and small-picture thinking. By that, I mean everyone knows what short-term means. But what I mean by small picture is focusing primarily on shareholder return over other stakeholders, from employees to communities to the national and global consequences of actions. We've had that for years. Same with too much debt. Also with, various shenanigans to avoid liability. These have long been three of the greatest contributors to an economy and a financial and resource allocation system that is failing. Failing to serve the greater good and the future. What jumps out to me about private equity is that it's designed to embody those three flaws. They are features, not bugs. Economist Branko Milanovic and Harvard Business School professor and author of Reimagining Capitalism in a World on Fire, Rebecca Henderson, both in conversations with me separately declared that where capitalism, which they both are okay with, where it goes wrong, where it fails as a system, is when business writes its own rules. And Ballou makes clear that that is the other piece of this phenomenon. Huge lobbying and hiring of big and small players in government through a revolving door kind of setup to create, preserve, and expand the advantages of private equity in the marketplace. Ballou also believes private equity can be stopped from wreaking further havoc, but we need the knowledge and the will to act. Brendan Ballou is a federal prosecutor and served, as I said, as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's antitrust division. Previously, he worked in private practice and before that in the National Security Division of the Justice Department, where he advised the White House on counterterrorism and other policies. He graduated from Columbia University and Stanford Law School, and as I said, Plunder is his first book. Welcome, Brendan Ballou, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me tell listeners we're recording this conversation Monday, June 12th. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us a bit about your path, how you got to the work you're doing today? And it would be tempting to start when you sort of went, what's going on here about private equity? But I'd prefer that you take it a little further back, how you, you know, may have chose your career. And you can go back to childhood inspirations, turning points, mentors, that sort of thing, and then take us up to what led maybe the inciting incident that led to the book.
Of course. And while it probably isn't terribly relevant for talking about my childhood, I should say that just across the board, I'm of course speaking in my personal capacity and not necessarily on behalf of the Justice Department.
Very good.
So, you know, I can talk about what drew me to private equity, but to answer your deeper question, I think I was drawn to the work of economic justice and trying to build a fairer, better economy, really through my parents and my mother, who was a community organizer in the Midwest before I was born. She was one of the people that helped work to make sure that utility companies couldn't so easily shut off power for residents who couldn't afford to pay their bill in the winter. And so I think her work and her life was really an inspiration for me about how to spend your time and what to try to work on. So I think that's what drew me to this work. In terms of what drew me specifically to private equity, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, I served as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department. Before I had that specific role, I was literally just going through the papers that companies file with DOJ and the FTC when they want to buy one another or merge, what are called HSR filings. And these companies that were getting bought were all getting bought by entities that I had never heard of. You know, as you mentioned, Blackstone, Carlyle, KKR, and so forth. It seemed like basically everything was getting bought up by these firms that I had no familiarity with. So I started researching them and learning more about private equity, what it is, you know, the effects that it has. And that's what ultimately drew me to this book project.
Were you surprised that no one had done this before?
Well, as much as I'd like to claim that that no one had done this before, there are a lot of people that have been looking at these issues, and I want to give them the enormous credit that they're due. Eileen Applebaum and Rosemary Batt have written a really wonderful book back in 2012, I believe, called Private Equity at Work: When Wall Street Manages Main Street. It was written for an academic audience, so there really had not been much written for sort of a popular audience on private equity, and that's what the niche that I was trying to fill.
Okay, that makes sense. And that is often what happens, and we all know about the Valley of Death. Usually it's attributed to like a research discovery in science that never makes it into the real world. But the same thing can happen with a discovery in terms of what's going on in the world that may never make it to the wider world. Let me ask if you had any response to my introduction in terms of, you know, how this hits someone like myself, or how, you know, how this whole area seems to, as I think what I sort of said there is like we hear it, but we don't know it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you did a really good job of summarizing the basic institutional flaws that change private equity firms' incentives to, you know, that lead to lots of bad results. I think to your point, what a lot of people don't realize is just how much private equity surrounds them and directs their lives. Private equity firms spent over $1 trillion buying companies last year. And, you know, for comparison or a sense of scale, the entire US GDP was $25 trillion last year. So when you look at just how you're living your life, you interact with private equity almost daily. When you go to a veterinary clinic or the OBGYN, when you go to the emergency room, buy a pair of shoes or a pair of slacks, you know, buy contacts, or, you know, in some cities, just get a glass of water from your tap, you are directly or indirectly supporting a private equity firm. You know, the interesting thing about it is, despite the fact that these businesses are enormous, Carlyle, KKR, and Blackstone in different orders, if they were considered with their portfolio companies, would be the third, fourth, and fifth largest employers in America after Walmart and Amazon. Despite the enormous scale of these companies, because they don't really brand themselves, rarely hear about a Mars-owned veterinary clinic or a Blackstone-owned hospital, or, you know, it really isn't sort of permeating public consciousness the way that it might normally.
I think that's real. I mean, to me, that is one of the crucial things, and what makes this sort of moment, as you and I said off air, Gretchen Morgenstern has a book on the same subject with a similar title. It seems to me, like, as I recall, back in 2006, 2007, there's a dawning. In your own case, you sort of said it was reading the submissions by companies that wanted to merge or purchase that you had to overlook that led to your curiosity. But was there a specific moment, a thing when you said, God, I've got to write about this?
You know, it was really reporting that Peter Orisky in the Washington Post was doing on private equity across industries. And I think the story that just grabbed me was the one that we ultimately began the book with, which was about Carlyle buying up the nursing home HCR ManorCare. And if you'll permit me, I can kind of briefly describe
that. Yes, I think that fleshing that out will help listeners. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Carlyle, as we mentioned, is one of the largest private equity firms in America. And around 2007, it bought HCR ManorCare, which at the time was the second largest nursing home chain in the country. And once it was bought, Carlyle executed a lot of tactics that are familiar for people that watch private equity. They required ManorCare to sell all of their real estate and then lease it back, which, you know, gives them a quick hit of cash, but now requires them to sort of pay rent on things that they used to own. They extracted money through transaction fees and management fees, so fees that are that the nursing home chain paid essentially for the privilege of being owned by a private equity firm. They cut staffing, and as a result, you know, nursing home complaints rose, complaints about health code violations, about roaches and pests in these nursing homes all went up. And at least one resident died. She, as alleged in her complaint, her family's complaint, hit her head on a bathroom fixture after she had to go to the bathroom by herself because there was nobody there to help her. And this was the part that really grabbed me. Was when the family of that woman sued Carlyle, Carlyle was able to get the case dismissed by saying, we are not technically the owners of this nursing home chain. Rather, we merely advise a series of funds whose limited partners, through several shell companies, ultimately own the chain. And that was enough to get the case against Carlyle dismissed. And Carlyle ultimately was not held responsible financially for that woman's death. And that was the story that galvanized me, because it showed that private equity firms, despite being able to control, you know, hundreds, thousands of companies, aren't necessarily going to be held responsible legally for the consequences of their actions.
You, by the way, I've seen you in other interviews point out that you are a lawyer, not an economist. And so it makes sense that that's the thread that sort of snagged for you, you know. But this decision that court made, that they were not responsible, is that Should that have been expected? Is that a surprise? And is that pretty consistent that as one of their model's primary legs of their stool, really, is this lack of liability? Is that assured?
Yeah, you know, it may or may not be a good thing, but it isn't particularly surprising. And to get in the weeds a little bit, this is called the doctrine of piercing the corporate veil, which basically holds that an investor shouldn't be held liable for the actions of the companies they invest in. And, you know, that makes sense maybe for you and me, where we've got our 401k and a couple shares in a company, but we don't, you know, control the operations of these businesses. It doesn't necessarily make sense for a private equity firm that may have a majority stake in the company and is able to effectively control its operations by choosing the board of directors, choosing the leadership, literally directing what the company should do. So we, at the moment, I would argue we have something of a mismatch in, between what the law allows and what our current business practices do.
Right. Right. You know, I sometimes think of these conversations, Brendan, in three stages. I call it, it's broke, let's fix it. And I just want to put it in the back of your mind. The first question is, how is it broke? What's the evidence? And you've given some of that, and I'm going to pad that a little bit with some numbers in a second. The second question is, how did it happen? What's the history? What's the story? What's the, who are the culprits? And the third one, which I always want to get to, and we will get to, and you do in your book as well, is what are the solutions and how can we fix it? In terms of the evidence, I got an email within the last week from Americans for Financial Reform, a progressive organization, nonprofit, and it was specifically about private equity, asking me to donate to them so that they could fight private equity. And some of the terms that were in this donation appeal were that Vice News just exposed that in 2021, in the midst of the pandemic, one single firm, Blackstone, spent $5.1 billion snapping up 80,000 units of low-income housing tax credits that had low-income housing tax credits, and their predictions were soon to expire. In recent years, the total gross assets of private funds, predominantly private equity firms and hedge funds, has grown to, as you pointed out, $18 trillion and is now nearly the same size as the overall $23 trillion in assets in the entire U.S. banking system. And then the evidence in, as you point out, the Carlyle healthcare situation. I will ask you in a second to tell us the Sun Capital Friendlies story. One of the things that it seems to me is going on here is there is clear evidence of both the huge size, and as you've pointed out, it's things you touch and drink and count on in your daily life that you don't know are held by these organizations. And the other evidence, I think, that sort of bridges into the history part is the enormous amount of lobbying and hiring of members of the government elite, if you will, to make sure that they keep the advantages they have. So tell us the Sun Capital Friendly story, because that's sort of, it's the same broad strategy, a slightly different tactic.
Of course. So the story of Sun Capital and Friendly's is really interesting. You know, Friendly's was this sort of iconic diner chain in the Northeast that served milkshakes and classic American fare. It was started by two brothers during the Great Depression who closed their store during World War II and put a sign out saying that they would come back once we won the war. So it was a really iconic chain. It was ultimately purchased by the private equity firm Sun Capital, which executed a lot of the tactics that we were just talking about in terms of fees, leasebacks, and so forth. They pushed the company into bankruptcy. And why would they do that? Mm-hmm. It's really interesting because Sun Capital wasn't just the largest owner of Friendly's, it was also the company's largest lender. And if you're familiar with the bankruptcy process, typically the lenders essentially assume control of the company, at least in many circumstances. So by being both the owner and the lender, Sun Capital was able to sell Friendly's from itself to itself. And the reason that they did that is by executing that move, they were able to push the pension obligations that Friendly's, the diner chain, had onto what's called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is this quasi-government agency. And it meant that Friendly's and Sun Capital wouldn't have those responsibilities to employees and retirees. So it was an example of where a private equity firm is able to sort of extract profits from a company, not necessarily by improving its operations, but through financial or legal machinations that push responsibilities to employees, to customers, off onto others.
Right. And as I said, this is this that example with a different twist than the earlier Carlyle healthcare example is another bit of the it's where the evidence for the problem overlaps with the history and the strategy of what they do. You make the point that private equity success is not necessarily in running businesses, although that is probably what they would hope people assume if they look into private equity at all, but really in using and abusing the financial and legal system, the context in which all of this takes place. And I think that's an interesting point. The companies often fail that they buy. You say they're 10 times more likely to declare bankruptcy.
That's right. You know, and private equity's defenders, you know, will quite reasonably say that only, you know, a portion of their deals fail. You know, many companies that are purchased by private equity succeed, you know, survive. Even succeed. But, you know, I always say, you know, not every Ford Pinto needs to explode for it to be unsafe at any speed. You know, by dramatically increasing the chance that a company may go bankrupt or suffer in some ways suggests that there might be misaligned incentives in the private equity sort of legal and regulatory structure. To go back to sort of your original observation, you know, I think that's right in that you look at who runs private equity firms. Unsurprisingly, it's people with financial backgrounds, not necessarily people who have experience in engineering, sales, marketing, logistics, operations, and so forth. And so because that's their experience, the changes that they tend to make typically are financial ones rather than operational ones, or looking critically at the legal system and seeing how it can be used to private equity firms' advantages. That's not illegal, but it's often somewhat different than the way that private equity firms present themselves in the public sort of debate.
Mm-hmm. And so that first question was, can the companies fail and the private equity firms succeed? The answer is an overwhelming yes. And even I noticed you said companies they own succeed and then kind of shifted that to survive, because often by pulling resources and so on, they make the company less able to thrive but able to survive. It seems that it's not just that. There's even the question of, do the investors make money? So we put the companies up against the private equity firms. What about the investors who are investing? As I said at the top, your description of what their method of doing business is a little of their own money, some more investor money, and ultimately a lot of debt.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you recapped where private equity firms get their money, because, you know, ultimately to buy a company you need money, and so they put up a little bit of their own, but at least a large part of their money comes from other investors. And those investors may be pension funds, they may be sovereign wealth funds, so, you know, funds from other countries, or they may be you know, very high net worth individuals. And there's an effort to sort of move private equity towards retail investors, which we can obviously talk about if you and your listeners are interested in. I think that at least in the short or medium term, many of those investors, what are called limited partners, seem to be somewhat happy. You know, the pension funds have called private equity, quote unquote, a superior form of capitalism. But I think that there is emerging research out there that suggests that private equity firms' returns may not be as robust as they publicly advertise, that some of the metrics that they use may be gameable in different ways. You know, ultimately, I defer to economists and financial analysts for that sort of research. You know, as we mentioned, I'm just a lawyer. But it is interesting that there's a sort of new emerging body of research. And to go back to the law here, one of the really interesting things is that often private equity firms will literally contract away their fiduciary obligations to their investors, saying that we do not necessarily need to act in the interest of our investors when we make our investment decisions. That is something that the SEC is looking at critically right now, but it suggests that there's sort of a daylight between what the investors want and what the private equity firms want.
Wow. So they shield themselves from the consequences legally, and then they even shift themselves from the consequences for their investors. It's pretty remarkable. Now, one thing I just want to jump on, and then we'll get into bigger questions, is you say that, or the fact is, that private equity firms make some of their money from the companies they buy through management fees that the company has to pay every quarter or every year for the privilege of being owned by them. What's that about? It seems crazy. And why do companies agree to that sort of a term?
So it's a cost of doing business with a private equity firm. Originally, as I understand it, management fees were instituted as a way to kind of keep the lights on in the private equity firm as they were, you know, reshaping the companies that they bought. That, you know, private equity firm buys up a business, it plans to hold it for 3 or 5 years, it needs enough money to keep going so that, you know, it can execute on its strategy. As I understand it, management fees have been, you know, sort of growing in size and importance as sort of as a actual revenue stream for private equity firms. And there's some really interesting work happening where, to again get in the weeds a little bit here, private equity firms are typically compensated on what's called a 2-in-20 model. So they get 2% of the funds that they invest every year plus 20% of the profits. They are trying to reorganize their contracts so that many of the management fees they get are treated as the tax-preferenced 20% rather than the 2%, all of which is a long and complicated way of saying that in addition to getting more money through management fees, they are working hard to get taxed less for the fees that they receive.
Wow. And to that sort of question, which I assume the answer is because they're desperate, why would you agree to, I'll be bought by you and I'll pay you fees for the right of being owned by you?
It's a great question. And it's one that I've asked many people about. Why would somebody agree to be bought by a private equity firm? And I think it goes to what are the interests of the executives of the company that's being bought? Oftentimes, when a large company is getting bought by a private equity firm, the executives are compensated by and large in stock. And so the purchase of the company by the private equity firm is a big payout for the executives. They're going to get, you know, cash for all that stock that they've got sitting out there. So oftentimes, whether or not this is in the long-term interest of the company, it may certainly be in the short-term interest of the executives that are running it. When you sort of go down the chain in size, a similar, maybe less nefarious story is happening. When you talk about private equity firms that are buying up, you know, OBGYN or other medical clinics, oftentimes what it is it will be a doctor who's, you know, worked at or run that clinic for a generation and is looking to retire. That's a great payout for them. It works well. But it doesn't necessarily work out for the doctors and the professional staff that remain, because now they're, you know, subject to sort of the direction of the private equity firm. There are complaints about, you know, essentially private equity firms making medical decisions rather than the doctors doing it, buying cheap supplies to such an extent that, you know, they, as alleged, they were buying needles that were so cheap that they would break off in people's arms. It's gotten to such an extent within the medical profession that, you know, if you go to job posting boards for dermatologists, for instance, you'll see job postings for specific clinics, and they'll literally say in the title of the job description in all caps, not private equity owned. And so to go back to your original question, it's a situation where the people that are currently running the business often succeed when the private equity firm buys it, but not necessarily for those that remain.
Right. So it sort of goes back to, I think, what I said in the introduction, that we've been beset by short-term, small-picture thinking for a long time. It's kind of, the, to some extent, the nature of the wealthy, of top management, of the C-suite. People have been railing against quarterly profits and short-term this and that for, you know, decades. But what we see is that there's an ideal match between a private equity firm and that sort of leadership of a company.
Oftentimes, yeah. In that, you know, the people that are leaving the company are going to get a payout.
Right.
And then there's often a sort of mirror image of that, in that private equity firms often have preferred executives who will run the companies that they acquire and will hop from company to company, or directors that are essentially directors for hire who will, or are employed by the private equity firm that will work for these companies. So, and they'll parachute in and, you know, oftentimes be compensated very well for their work.
Sure. Sure. Okay. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking today with Brendan Ballou, a federal prosecutor who served as special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's antitrust division. And we're talking about his first book, Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. And you can learn more at plunderthebook.com. Before I ask my next question, let me just add a little more to that notion I mentioned earlier, which is the evidence of the destructive nature of private equity. And these are some statistics that I picked up along the way. Companies bought by private equity firms are far more likely to go bankrupt than companies that aren't. We talked about that. Over the last decade, private equity firms were responsible for nearly 600,000 job losses in the retail sector alone. And this was pre-pandemic. This was when the retail sector was doing very well. In nursing homes, where they've been particularly active, private equity ownership is responsible for an estimated 20,000 premature deaths over a 12-year period, according to a recent working paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research. And then, as Brendan mentioned, how it's all around you, only you don't know it, similar tales can be told in mobile homes, prison healthcare, prison phone systems, emergency medicine, ambulance, apartment buildings, and elsewhere. The companies, as we said, this is Blackstone, Carlyle, KKR, Bain, Apollo, Sun Capital, etc. When you hear those names, you can assume this is private equity. And the thing that I noticed, I think Lynn Paramore said in an introduction to an interview she did with you, if the restaurant you're used to, or, you know, maybe even the hospital you're used to, suddenly seems to be running a tighter ship and falling down on their service, and just you kind of notice things aren't the way they used to be, often the explanation will be that the larger company that owns your, the concern that you deal with on a daily basis has been bought by private equity. So let's talk about their power to rig the system in their favor, their power to, as I said, write the rules that they play by. Just a couple of notes. Among the folks they've hired, Timothy Geithner, who ran the bank rescue system under Obama, Newt Gingrich, Paul Ryan, two speakers of the House, David Petraeus. These are all the sorts of individuals that have been hired by private equity to curry favor in the halls of legislation and regulation. So talk a bit about their lobbying muscle and their hiring practices.
So it's pretty extraordinary. Private equity firms and investment firms have given some $900 million in contributions to federal candidates and elected officials since 1990. They have hired some of the leading lights of the government. You know, you already mentioned several of them. It includes secretaries of Treasury, secretaries of state, defense, chairmen of the SEC and FCC, any number of senators and congresspeople. And they have been extraordinarily effective at advancing their agenda, both in Congress and across agencies and in the states. I think the sort of story that most people refer to is the fight over what's called the carried interest loophole. The carried interest loophole is this essentially idea that private equity firm executives and others can pay a lower effective tax rate than you and I do. It's something that presidents have been trying to close at least since President Obama, actually when he was still a senator, he was campaigning against it. He was unable to close it. Interestingly enough, President Trump was also opposed to closing the carried interest loophole. He failed. And most recently, President Biden tried to do this, but first through his budget and then through what ultimately became the Inflation Reduction Act. Not only were private equity and other firms able to protect the carried interest loophole through that debate, they were actually able to get a clarification that gave them sort of a new tax advantage at a time when, you know, every other amendment on, you know, granting, you know, expanding Medicare to include health, you know, vision and dental benefits, or expanding free lunch programs. As all of these amendments were failing, a single amendment to expand the tax benefits for private equity and related firms did pass. So it's an example of where I think the industry has just been almost astoundingly successful in mm-hmm. advancing its agenda.
Mm-hmm. So as we said, their expertise and the route to their success does not come through managing thriving companies and running businesses extraordinarily well, but using and abusing the laws, the systems, and in this case, the government. As you point out, the largest firms each spent $3 to $7 million lobbying in 2021 when Biden was trying to get that benefit into his first budget. And you also point out, and this one blew my mind, Blackstone Steven Schwarzman income in 2022 was 50 times that of the chief executive of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
50 times. And if you asked people, you know, from the 2008 crash, who was the big boogeyman, it might have been Goldman Sachs.
I can't remember what the exact multiple was on the differential in their earnings, but it is kind of amazing how much more executives at private equity firms can make than executives at investment banks, which, you know, I think, as you're suggesting, are far better known by Americans
yes.
Than, you know, institutions like Blackstone, Carlyle, KKR are.
Okay, so I've often said that when I look out at the big picture, that our incentive structures seem to be way off in terms of, if we go back to those crises that I mentioned at the top, whether they're public health crises, inequality crises, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. And let me just, almost as an aside here, say what we're talking about when you have private equity for years buying and gutting things that serve middle class and working class people, that is a under the radar, if you will, contributor to the anxiety, the anger, the rage, the grievance that can then be played by authoritarian leaning, white nationalist leaning, et cetera, politicians. In which you get the greedy elites courting the very people that they are failing to serve, and in the bargain, supporting social grievance that brings out the worst in our society. But so two things there. One is talk about how they actually favor industries that serve poorer communities.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of surprising, you know, for a business that's all about making money, you would sort of think that they would target industries that served rich people because that's where the money is. To my surprise, often private equity firms instead went after industries that service the poor or working class people. So we're talking payday lenders, for-profit colleges, prison services, mobile homes, and so forth. And I think the common thread between all those different industries is that they're ones where oftentimes the customers really don't have an alternative, and so are willing to put up with higher costs or lower quality of care because there's really no other choice. I think the most extreme example of this is prison services,
where
private equity firms have been enormously active, buying up prison phone companies, prison cafeterias and commissary services, prison healthcare companies, and so forth. And the allegations made against these companies are pretty extraordinary. You know, when you're talking about cafeterias, that these PE-owned businesses were serving meat that was literally labeled on the boxes, not fit for human consumption. That when you're talking about PE-owned healthcare companies, that there are cases where prisons had to take drug holidays because they didn't have enough drugs to service the whole population, or where a woman had to give birth in her cell by herself because no nurse or doctor would come to her aid. When you're talking about prison phone services, that people are having to pay, you know, upwards of $10, $15 for a 15-minute phone call, it suggests that these are industries where the purchasers, private equity firms, realize that there's a lot of money to be made because they have a literally captive audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the case of prisons, literally so, yes. Talk a little bit more, if you will, about people may think that prisons don't touch them, but it seems to me the places where it gets really scary is, again, not necessarily retail and so on, but medical, pension, and then 401ks, and now you say a new horizon is the insurance business. Those are things which we count on. Rich or poor, I think all of us that have access to any of those, some people don't have access to pensions or 401ks and can't afford insurance. But for those that have access to it, these are things we count on, and those are in their crosshairs.
Yeah, why don't we start with those last ones first, and then we can work our way backwards. So insurance is really interesting in that private equity firms, you know, as we've sort of been talking about earlier, need money to buy up companies. And in some ways, they've sort of tapped their traditional resources, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, and so forth, and so have turned to buying up insurance companies, which offers them an opportunity because you and I essentially pay monthly or quarterly premiums to a life insurance company, for instance, that'll ultimately, you know, have a payout when we die. They are able to use that monthly or quarterly money to fund their various projects in private equity and infrastructure and so much else. What's really interesting is that there's reporting in the trade publications on insurance and now increasingly in the popular press about how private equity firms are essentially moving a lot of these assets to offshore affiliates in the Bahamas that or Bermuda, mm-hmm. that have lower capital requirements than here in the United States. So what that means essentially is they have to keep less money on hand in case things go bad, and they've got more money that they can play with for their various projects. You know, that may sound familiar to folks who lived through the Great Recession and remember when there was discussion about capital requirements and liquidity. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that a disaster is inevitable, but it suggests that, you know, a disaster is somewhat more likely. And the really interesting thing is, and I'm not an insurance lawyer, so I don't want to get too, you know, mm-hmm. over my head here, but traditionally when an insurance company fails, The responsibility for the plans are ultimately assumed by state guarantee corporations and the state that the insurance company was headquartered. And so what that means is, and that's a fund that other more responsible insurers pay into.
Sure.
And so what that means is if a private equity firm buys up an insurance company, moves assets offshore, and then the insurance company ultimately fails, it won't necessarily be the private equity firm that's on the hook for paying all those dues that they have for their customers. Rather, it's other insurance companies that were more responsible and more prudent that may have to take on those responsibilities.
I mean, it even seems to me the point that I made in asking that question, which is these are things that people rely on. These are not luxuries. In some sense, that makes them even a greater target because government, when it's doing its job, creates a safety net for the sorts of things that families and individuals ultimately rely on.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think private equity firms are in some ways assuming the role of government in certain services. You know, I alluded to this earlier, but, you know, PE firms are, for instance, or have bought up municipal water services.
Right.
They are buying up, you know, colleges. They are, in some places, providing fire services.
So when we talk about a march toward privatization, a campaign for privatization, that used to just be, you know, privatization. But what you're saying is that very often privatization means private equity.
Yeah. I think the really interesting area is ambulances, where, you know, for people in younger generations, I don't think that they are even really aware that ambulances, by and large, used to be run by, you know, municipalities. Now mm-hmm. they are increasingly privatized, and it's an industry where private equity firms have been very active.
I will say I had a staph infection a few years ago. And when I looked at it, was a severe one. I was, you know, laid up for 4 months. When I looked at my bills, my insurance had covered almost everything. My ambulance bill was the biggest bill I had.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, when you're talking about surprise medical billing,
yes.
It's something that affects millions of Americans. And it's one that Congress actually was able to pass legislation on, despite the millions of dollars that private equity firms spent. Yet, ambulances were excepted from that bill, so it's still possible to get a surprise bill from an ambulance.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk then just a little bit about pensions. Again, something that people are counting on.
Yeah. So, you know, pensions are one of the primary sources of funding for private equity firms. You know, it's an area where there's actually kind of a symbiosis between private equity firms and pension funds. One of the unfortunate things is there's some reporting about how pension funds, which obviously are often, if not usually, coming from union workforces, teachers, firefighters, police, mm-hmm. and so forth, are being used to fund acquisitions and ultimately anti-union or anti-labor actions at those businesses.
Mm. Okay, let's go to solutions, okay? And one thing that I think is helpful in your assessment here is that by pointing out the three big flaws, which is the short-term thinking and how that impacts decision-making, the large debt and how that affects decision-making, and then the insulation from liability for consequences. Once you say, okay, these are the three things, we have to patch those holes in the dike. And in fact, so as I think I alluded to earlier, incentives are crucial, and they've been able, for the most part, to keep the incentives in their favor so far. Talk about where, and I think, as you say, I'm just going to put this up before you have to say it, is that Congress would be the ultimate place, as there was that battle over the budget, there was the battle over the Inflation Reduction Act. Congress is the ultimate place where the rules can be set, but if Congress is going to be stalemated by minority rule and by intense lobbying, then there are other avenues, and you've pointed out in some cases where advocates have been successful already.
Yeah, I think that there are a couple areas where advocates have been really successful. One is the area that we were just talking about, prisons. There has been a really effective lobbying campaign to cap the cost of prison phone calls that started with local legislation, I believe, in New York and San Francisco, moved to state legislation in Connecticut, and ultimately federal legislation just passed last year to give the FCC more robust rulemaking authority here. So I think it's an area where if activists choose specific industries that people can understand where the injustice is, they can be really effective. Now, ultimately, you know, what we need to do is solve the three problems that we were talking about: short-term thinking, reliance on debt and fees, and insulation from liability. Congress can play a role here and could act on these, but so too can states and localities, you know, requiring, for instance, that if a private equity firm buys a business in its jurisdiction, that it not enact, you know, exact onerous fees or execute things like sale leasebacks, which we were talking about earlier. There are things that,
you know, just for a second, sale leaseback, we talked about earlier, but just remind people what that is.
Yeah, so that's where the private equity firm requires the company to sell its assets and then lease it back. So, you know, if you've got stores, you require the store to be sold and then lease back the property. It gets this quick hit of cash, but it means that now you have sort of this unending financial obligation.
You've made owners into renters and you took the profit.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, there are things that can be happen at the state level, happen at the local level. There are things that federal regulators can do, whether it's the SEC, Health and Human Services, Treasury Department, Federal Reserve, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. So I think, you know, while people typically look to Congress and there are things that Congress can do here, there are a lot of different levers that people can pull to enact change here.
Okay. And as you say, it may come down in, as you lay out in the book, in different sectors, different agencies. HHS when it comes to nursing homes, FCC when it comes to prison phones, Fannie and Freddie when it comes to housing. But it seems to me the upstream of any hope for that is education and activation, because this juggernaut is well educated on what it wants and relentless and well funded in how it goes after it. So how do you see that, the current environment for that education and activation, so that we you know, we can begin to successfully push back?
Well, this is an area where I'm hopeful. You know, it's, you know, programs like yours helps get the word out about what private equity firms are and the kind of things that they do. I'm really grateful, you know, when people have been reaching out to me, talking about their experience with private equity and what you know, they want to know what they can do. I would encourage people to, you know, learn about private equity, learn about, you know, the incentives that it has and what, you know, can be done at a policy level, but also not to underestimate your own power here. You know, I say this as somebody that, you know, has worked in government several times. You know, public sentiment, you know, outrage, anger, encouragement really can affect people in these big bureaucracies who are trying to do the right thing, you know, but may not feel that they can speak up or want to do the right thing, but don't necessarily know what the right thing is. So I will say, even if you don't necessarily see it, people talking about these issues, people raising their voice really can have an impact.
Okay. Places where people can learn more. Books, websites, you know, any of that sort of thing, but in addition to your book, Plunder.
Well, you know, I already mentioned some of the academic research. Gretchen Morgenson, as you mentioned, has a wonderful book out. I'd recommend, in terms of organizations, there are groups that are, you know, I'm not familiar with everything that they do, but, you know, what I've seen suggests that they're doing really interesting work, that are working on these things. You already mentioned one of them, Americans for Financial Reform.
Right.
But also the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, United for Change, the American Economic Liberties Project, and so many others. I just encourage folks to go to their websites and learn more about these things, because there's a lot that can be learned, but it's also accessible. You know, this doesn't necessarily need to be really complicated, dense, boring stuff.
Okay. Finally, just let me ask you what questions you're asking now. The questions you asked a couple of years ago resulted in this book. What are the questions you're asking now? And you can let this be kind of your closing thoughts.
Well, now I'm starting to think about, you know, this was about, by and large, private companies. Now I'm starting to try to do some research on public companies. And this idea of shareholder supremacy, which it turns out is a concept that has was invented relatively recently, and trying to understand where it came from and the consequences that it's had for, you know, making our economy work or not work is something that I'm trying to learn more about now.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I often point to 1970 when Lewis Powell wrote the Powell memo, leading to, you know, a kind of a reassessment and refocusing of business's approach to politics. But also, Friedman wrote the declared that shareholder value was the only goal of business. And 1970 just was not that long ago. What it was immediately following a Republican president, Nixon, signing the EPA and OSHA laws.
Mm. Yeah. No, that's a really good point.
Okay. Thank you. Let me tell people, the book again is Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. The website is plunderthebook.com. Now, Plunder the Book is not one of those that's going to give you a ton of research. It's going to mainly focus on the book, where to buy it, some things like that. But you can find more of Brendan's writing at The Atlantic, at The Nation, and other publications. So you just go Brendan Ballou, and that's B-A-L-L-O-U, and look for him, and you'll see some more of his writing. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 or 15 links to articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, most of the major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at those sites or at mine. Archives include Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, Brendan Ballou, keep up your good work.
Thank you so much for the time.